get down, little Henry Lee, and stay all night with me. You won't find a girl in this damn world that will compare with me. The wind did howl, and the wind did blow. La 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 la, la 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 la. A little bird who let down on Henry Lee. I can't get down. And
good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Today I'm so happy to have Diane Seuss joining us via telephone. Diane, welcome back to Living Writers.
Hey, thank you. Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's so good to hear your voice. I've missed you.
it's been
a couple of years.
I know. And a lot has gone down in those years, you know?
Diane, I've only written it to you, but congratulations on winning the Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you so much.
And the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award. Well, that was for an earlier book, but still.
No, like, that was for this one. That was for Frank.
It was for Frank. Because Frank Sonnets,
yeah.
I mean, I wanted to mention these other prizes because sometimes once you hear Pulitzer Prize, like sometimes the others are, but they're also so important as well.
They're just as important. And for instance, the National Book Critics Circle Award it comes from critics and it has a different vibe, I guess. And each one is equally precious to me.
Diane, what was it like to, like, which one came first? Like, which of, yeah.
Good question. I think it was the Penn Volcker Award, and I was shocked by that. And then they, you know, it just started happening where, you know, maybe next was the National Book Critics Circle and then the L.A. Times, and I kept thinking, you know, this can't happen again. This is too much. And then, you know, I had sort of forgotten about the Pulitzer. Who dreams of that? Especially who dreams of that from Niles, Michigan, you know?
Yeah.
And but I tuned in to the ceremony just to hear it. And, you know, there my name was. And I still don't know if I have receptors for that moment, or, you know, I'm looking at it across the room from me right now, the crystal that came in a Tiffany box and bag. And, you know, it means so much to me. And yet at the same time, I'm exactly the same person and writer I've always been. I don't feel like it pumped me up in any way. It just was this glorious accident.
But then it just shows how you are truly meant to be awarded that prize and all of them, just to hear you talk about it, Diane. Oh.
Yeah, what was cool to me is that a lot of people said who read my work or who, you know, follow me on social media or whatever, that it felt like a victory for them too. Mm. And I'm more comfortable with that in mind, that whatever it is I represent or don't represent, people felt seen and heard.
Yes.
When I got those awards, and I hope that has continued. I do hear from people who say, you know, you wrote about your own life from a rural place and a very working class family, and I never thought that I had the right to write those aspects of my story, and now I do. So that is a good thing.
Yes. Imagine like being able to see a story that you deeply resonate out in the world, and then being able then to feel like you could tell your story or try to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was coming up, there were those kinds of the stories that reflected my life in any way were few and far between. Probably it wasn't until, and I do talk about this in my new book, Modern Poetry, in the title poem, that I took a course called Women's Literature.
Yes.
At Western Michigan University, across the hill from Kalamazoo College, where I was a student. And suddenly I was seeing stories that echoed or refracted within mine. That was a big moment. And I don't think I really knew that there was such a thing as a woman writer until that course.
And how old were you then, Diane?
Let's see. I was probably 19, 20. Wow. And in fact, the photo of me on the cover of Modern Poetry is I'm 18 in that photo.
Oh, it's such a wonderful photo of you.
Well, what was funny, I was at my mom's, you know, not that long before the book was going into production. And she said, "Look what I found." And it was in her billfold, and that little photo. Oh. And it had been in her photo, in her billfold for 40 years.
Goodness.
And so I said, "Hey, can I borrow this?" I just had a feeling about it. And I sent it to Grey Wolf, and they were willing to use it.
It's beautiful. Yeah, and Grey Wolf Press, a shout out to them and to Jeff Schatz there as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no, the books that I've written under their tent, there would not have happened without the press and Jeff. You know, the dedication to Modern Poetry is to my reader, capital R.
Oh.
And I really, I meant it both generally, but specifically toward Jeff.
Because you put that in the acknowledgments too. Sorry to.
Yes. I experience him as, you know, I don't know if it's true for all writers, but I think I need a human recipient to write toward. It's not like I'm writing for him, but I am writing toward him. Not his approval or anything like that, but just the human presence. And to know that such a great reader and critic and editor is there receiving my work, it helps me not feel like I'm singing into the void.
Yes, because that's what, because poems are singing, but they're, yeah, singing outward.
Yes, I don't think we would do them otherwise. And in this book, there's a great emphasis on the singing.
Yes. Say more, please.
Well, that's not something that I've ever. You know, I notice my resistance to certain aspects of craft peels away over time. Mm. When I was a young writer, I was a storyteller. You know, I've got a tale for you. And I think I get that by way of my family history. My mother's a great storyteller, etc. But, and I never was all that interested in music aside from the accidental music that comes into the poem. And I really wasn't that grooved about line and line break. And as I evolve, those things come into my notice, and suddenly I can't live without them. So for me, at least, a writing life is really an evolution. And a, you know, I'm over days and weeks and months and years, I'm integrating all of those aspects of writing poems that earlier I shut out. And I think, you know, it's like a baby. They need to walk. They need to focus on walking. And then they can focus on talking, and then they can focus on getting the spoon to their mouth. Well, I'm that simple, you know. So in this book, I really made the decision. I want music to be at the forefront, and so I studied some music. I studied classical forms. I studied music types. I got interested in the fugue and the ballad. And as I said in a poem called My Education in the book, you know, I study things until I've got it, and then I've got it. Mm. For some reason, I felt like this book needed musical structures to hold it up. Maybe it was to hold me up, because I was, the encounters in this book were the most difficult that I've ever chosen for myself.
How so?
So Frank had happened, and then the pandemic was here. And I was really alone. I live alone. And, you know, because of isolation, I was it. And like so many of us. And then in the midst of that, my dog, Bear, died.
Oh.
Yeah, Bear died.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was, I mean, we were soulmates. And then I think because of everything going on at that time, including political realities in this country and globally, I began to feel a level of despair that I hadn't encountered before. And the despair funneled into this question, which was, does poetry even matter? Does it matter anymore? Did it ever matter? Does it still have the capacity to mean? And taking on that question was a really scary proposition, because if it stopped meaning, I'd hung every gown on that hanger, you know?
Yes.
And if that broke, I was really in trouble. So that's how I walk into this book.
Diane, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back. And together, let's take the listeners into modern poetry.
Oh, I'd love it. Thank you.
Okay, take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Diane Seuss joins us via phone from Niles, Michigan. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today, Diane Seuss is here on Living Writers via phone. Diane, thanks for being here via phone, and thanks for picking today's songs, too.
Oh, yeah. That was fun. I have a frustrated dream of being a DJ.
You gotta come to Ann Arbor. Let's get you on the air live, spinning some of your tunes. Definitely.
I would love that. Yeah, this book was so great to think about music for, because you know, as I said, it's so grounded in music.
Diane, do you, because right before we started taping today, we were talking about you may be reading the first poem. I wanted to do a quick shout out to your poem towards the end of the book, Against Poetry, because what right before the break, what you were talking about felt so like I could also, I understand when you said despair was away.
And
maybe we'll get there again, but I wanted you to have a chance, because you had said, let's start with that first poem in modern poetry.
I'm happy to, and I'm also happy to read Against Poetry, whatever you wish.
Diane, you choose.
Okay. Well, I'll read the first poem because I think it's a good entry point for the listener, because it's called Little Fugue State. And a fugue is a type of musical composition, but also the fugue state is something that happens often after a head injury where you're lost and you don't know who or where or what you are. And that's kind of the terms that I set at the beginning of this book. And you'll hear the music in this poem. Little Fugue State. Far have I wandered, not knowing the names of where. Long have I woven this dress of human hair. Here I have pitched my tent, here and there, not knowing my name or where, not even the color of my hair, nor why it tangles so, nor where my comb goes, nor where my brush, how far I wandered through underbrush into onrush, nor where my body was, nor what it called itself, nor the nature of my calling, nor what my scrawling meant. Not that scrawl then, nor this scrawl here, nor what a self could be, nor what a bee could be, nor breath, nor poetry. This dog I've walked and walked to death.
Thank you, Diane.
Yeah.
Yep, you can hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that poem, I think, moved me in the direction of ballads as well, unconventional or contemporary ballads, because of that circularity, that, you know, moving out and moving back, that return, almost a stuckness in a cycle that interested me with ballads. And so that became, the fugue and the ballad became the sort of underpinnings of form in the book. There's a lot of free verse and all, but I do those two forms here.
And what was it like making this poem that may have been different than when you were making or drafting previous poems, like what you let yourself do?
Yes, good question. You know, it's interesting because I don't ever want to write the same book twice. And Frank Sonnets was American Sonnets, contemporary sonnets. And the diction, even when I rhymed and metered, the diction was still comfortable and intimate in a sense. And I needed to take a turn with this book. That's not what I was feeling.
Mm.
And there's something different here that is, in a sense, more formal in the musical sense, that's maybe a little colder. And in fact, objectivity as a value became a big part of this book. And I arrived at that through the poems. It wasn't something I came to the book and thought, oh, I'm going to write about objectivity. My poems always lead me. And so ultimately, I found myself at the valuing objectivity in poems and in love.
Yes.
Yeah.
And because there's one of your poems also, I think, features your father, Diane, when he calls you Di.
And... yeah, pop song. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a real surprise that, you know, I've written about my father since I was a small child. He died when I was 7. And in always in ways, you know, we were very close, I guess, and intimate and connected. And in this poem, I meet him again as the person I am now, and he's sort of not that interested. there's a distancing, and I was thinking, you know, maybe the dead too evolve in their connection to the living.
Yeah,
maybe it's not, you know, and I mean, the end of the poem, he sort of says, "Di, you know, nice to see ya." Like you would an acquaintance.
Yes. And when you found that, because it feels like a surprise to feel like that is what he said.
Yeah. I felt just like it would feel if it really happened. I felt like, ouch, you know? But I also, part of me, you can't go there unless part of you is already there. And, you know, as an evolving person, I find myself, there's almost a Buddhist kind of detachment that I end up with in this book, that I don't know, that has just come to me through these last years in this process. And something of being alive and being in it, but also being an observer of it, and not being so bound up in the story, in the theater of life, but being able to look at it from a distance. There's John Keats is a big player in this book. The romantic poet, John Keats. and you know, I have one of the poems, he's already gone, he's already dead, but he can re-experience life by kind of looking in the windows, and he looks on the woman he was in love with in life, and he doesn't see her in the same way. He says something like, you know, it's he doesn't find her beautiful, but objectivity itself, that is beautiful.
And that's coming towards in the arc of how you've structured modern poetry, Diane. That's towards the very end, high romance.
Yes, it is. And in fact, the book, I think it's I hate this word, but I'll say it, journey. It's journey leads us in the direction of a reinvented notions about love and poetry and connection, self-love.
Yes, yes.
That too. And so it does arrive, it does revalue all of those things, but it takes a pretty difficult path, a circuitous fugue-like path.
And the ballad, like that return.
Yes. You know, I heard Gwendolyn Brooks read a couple times when I was younger, and she was an amazing writer of ballads. She had one that I heard her read called The Ballad of Pearl May Lee that just, oh my God, I've never gotten over it. And so this idea of messing with ballads, I could hear her voice ringing inside of me as I went. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Because there was no voice like Gwendolyn Brooks' voice, no voice. I wasn't trying to be her, imitate her. There's no way. But I again, it's like Keats and Brooks and Frank O'Hara and other poets of the past. They become nettlers and supporters as I work. Because I work lonely, and they hold me up.
That's beautiful, and that's who I think that you're mentioning. Who's on the other side of the grass?
In
the acknowledgments, is that right?
Yes, yeah. The dead, you know, Kevin Young, the poet, Kevin Young.
Yes.
He has a great essay that I always mention called Deadism. And he writes it in response to some critic who says poetry's dead one more time. And Kevin Young says, I'm paraphrasing, you know, how about instead of arguing about it being dead, let us write from the dead. Let us write from dead. Deadism itself. And that rang true for me. Because I always, you know, since I was a little girl, had one foot in the grave in a very dynamic way.
With the loss of your father, yes.
My father, I mean, poetry became the way I stayed with him. We lived in a little village, Edwardsburg. And we lived next door to the cemetery. And, you know, at age 3 and 4, I would walk down Cemetery Lane into the cemetery. It wasn't a scary place to me. It was a beautiful place. And the milkweeds and the bullfrogs and the hognose snakes and the cemetery horses. Life was there.
Yeah.
And so my work is always... you know, speaking both to the living and the dead, and speaking from the dead, who don't get to speak for themselves often enough.
Yes. And who don't leave us, as we've been talking about, too.
Right. You know, Keats has a poem, a fragment that he wrote right toward the end of his life, where he basically says, it's your job, reader, to keep me alive. And I take that very seriously. You know, it's like remember those capsules, and you put them in water and a dinosaur, like a sponge dinosaur, would come out? Or they're for kids.
Yeah, or the sea monkeys?
God, I love those. Which you pictured wearing crowns and stuff, but they were just brine shrimp. But, yeah, or having little nurseries of sea monkeys. But, yeah, so you know, it's like you have to add your attention to Keats' poems in order to keep him alive. It's like clapping for Tinkerbell.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I take my responsibility to the dead very seriously. My mother does it by keeping the graves cleaned up.
Yes.
And, you know, that's, that is one of her main pieces, I guess, rituals of meaning. And for me, it's through poems.
And in my education, one of my favorite lines I had to write, love next to this, the cemetery is unsystematic.
Yes, yes, it is. At least the one I live next door to.
Graves scattered like chicken feed. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, or even, you know, I talk about the corn kernels that back in the old days, you know, corn wasn't constructed to be perfect like it is now, you know. Corn was, you know, scattershot. So, you know, it's just a cobbled life, you know?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
And my project was my life. So many beautiful moments. Diane, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Because otherwise, okay, I'll just talk through all the breaks with you, I think. but we'll take a short break today on Living Writers. Diane Seuss joins us via phone. Her latest book out with Grey Wolf Press, Modern Poetry. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Many is the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right, I'm all right. I'm just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers, and today on the program, Diane Seuss joins us via phone. Diane, thanks again for picking the songs.
I'm here like, oh, I want to just keep listening.
It is hard to like fade them out. I'm glad that's Jason's job.
Jason, our hero, fading the song.
Completely. Otherwise, I think you and I would just be listening to it and smiling, right?
Yes. Yep.
You know, Diane, earlier you had mentioned how modern poetry, the book that we're talking about today on the table with us, is a book about evolving as a person, and that there's this Buddhist detachment that you end up with. And hearing you say that, it was so eye-opening for me, because I was going to ask you about this really small, like, structural thing, because I wondered, like, because when you're trying to, like, you read us the first poem in the book, because you said this is the way for the reader in, you know, of course, in a book of poems, you don't know how people are going to be in it, but as the poet, there, you are putting them in an order. There is like a way if they wanted to read it, right? And
yes.
So for your last section in this one, because there are pauses, there's these moments of where the beats, like there's breaks in the movement among the poems. And in the last section, there's the two last poems like that face each other are Gertrude Stein and romantic poet.
Yes.
And when I looked at these, I thought, I wonder why you didn't flip them. And then I thought, well, yeah, I had some ideas about it. But I think it's because of the last line.
It is.
Would you want to read the last poem, or would that be?
Of course. Yes. I like that poem. And it's one of those poems that just came to me as a gift. I can't take responsibility for it. Let me just say, you know, there's one of the tensions or explorations in the book is between modernism, what is called modern, and the romantic, and all of the inflections around those words. And this poem is another poem that's kind of focused on Keats. And the only thing I think the reader might need to know is that one of his famous poems is Ode to the Nightingale, and you will hear that. Romantic poet. "You would not have loved him, my friend the scholar," you cried. "He brushed his teeth, if at all, with salt. He lied and rarely washed his hair. Wiped his ass with leaves or with his hand. The top of his head would have barely reached your tits. His pits reeked, as did his deathbed." "But the nightingale," I said.
Thank you. And so for you, Diane, with this, because there's the threads throughout the book. As you told us, the tension between modernism and the romantic, but there's romantic poetry. The title is Modern Poetry. There's these different, you know, I think on page. It's why was it important for you to end on this note? Not trying to be a punny.
Well, you know, I think in that last line is the answer to all of the book's questions. And that is, there's all kinds of stuff that you can say about poetry or about the poet or about love and the lover, about life. But, and you could, you know, there's all the critics come flocking, but the nightingale, I said, there is no arguing with that poem, with the nightingale, with the bird, and with the song.
Yeah. And with Keats'
song. It is
song.
Beyond argument.
Yes. And I think it's important that you have the phrase "I said" there with the period as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It also rhymes with deathbed.
Totally. Which is where we're finding the music, right? After the pause.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's music, there's rhyme all throughout this little poem, you know? And so that's really why music was so important to this book, is that even though I take the reader through what for me was a harrowing period of in the desert where my belief was really being questioned, the persistence of music is there as sort of a clue to say, we'll get there.
Yeah.
You know, the music is still there, but the nightingale, I said.
And I think it's so important. Like, I feel like this book is a book that it will be wonderful when if people read it from the first to the last, you know, how it moves and how it's built. Because...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah, I'm really appreciative that you see that, because it really has an architecture from front to back. And that's how people should read it, not in fits and starts, if they're willing.
And when you were writing the poems, like, this is not an architecture you could be aware of. Like, maybe some of the poems are naturally falling chronologically, because as you've kind of explained a little bit or talked about, you were having these discoveries as you were writing the poems. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's how you ordered them, right, Diane? Or
right. They weren't. This isn't a linear order in the way that Frank Sonnet's. I pretty much was the order of the poems was the order of their writing, which is very unusual. In this book, I really struggled. I suffered for the order because I wanted it. Oh, this is something I need to say, that I think it has an almost rhetorical structure. It has a conflict. It has something it's arguing around or for or against, and it's moving through layers of argumentation in various forms to get at "But the Nightingale," I said. And so it needed a rhetorical structure in its ordering. Doesn't that sound heady and boring?
No, I'm interested. I'm nodding along.
Okay, because, and you know, maybe in this book, I mean, calling a book of poems modern poetry.
Love it.
A bit audacious.
It is. I love that.
But it's, you know, modern poetry was my first poetry class ever and the first textbook I ever saw that my mother brought into the house because she went to college after my dad died. And I was too young to approach it, but it was in my vision, you know. Mm. And so to, you know, I think the photo of me on the cover is a clue to how to hear that, you know, here's this snot-nosed 18-year-old who really wasn't prepared and didn't know much, who, in a raw way, comes into poetry. And there's nothing wrong, I say in the book, I think, with that rawness.
Yes.
We begin to cobble together a life, a brain, an intellect, an imagination, an aesthetic. And that's what we do. And if you don't have certain privileges, then your cobbling is messier. But it's what we must do. And so this is, you know, in quotes, sort of a mock or parody in a way of a textbook, but it's a very iconoclastic, personal textbook.
Yeah.
It's a mess in a way, you know, it's cobbled. But as it marches forward, it kind of finds its groove and argues its points, sometimes rather harshly, mm-hmm. in order to get to the Nightingale.
Yes. And I love it. And I mean, there is a line in the poem that we were talking about before, Diane, Pop Song, where I think a line before your father's last line says, Jesus judges, I think something like that. You know, and then
Jesus judges us. Yeah.
Right. And then your father says, mm-hmm. good to see you, which feels like it's arguing with the line before it. Like it's so I know that was something that felt cold to you, but in a way I also felt it was going towards the objectivity. Like he wasn't mm-hmm. judging in that way. That
a release.
Yeah.
A release.
Yeah.
You know, when a beloved parent dies when a kid is young, I think it's almost like the plot of your life becomes about sustaining that attachment or understanding that parent or imagining that parent, internalizing them. And at this phase of my life, I suddenly began to see the possibilities of detaching. And that's a whole evolution. I feel like I'm on Dr. Freud's couch.
Well, I'm nodding, and I was going to say, and hard won in a way. Not that it's over.
Hard won. Yeah, because there's, I mean, the Nightingale at the end does, I think, promise there's a next thing, you know. There's still poetry. What that looks like, I'm still trying to figure out. But there's always a next phase.
Diane, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be back. This one will be quick, everybody. Today on Living Writers, Diane Seuss, her latest book out with Grey Wolf Press, Modern Poetry. We'll be back.
Nightingale, sing us a song of a love that once belonged. Nightingale, tell me your tale. Was your journey far too long? Does it seem like I'm looking for to a question I can't ask? I don't know which way the feather falls.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today, Diane Seuss joins us via phone, and we're talking about her latest book of poems, Modern Poetry. Diane, we're in our last bit here.
Our last hurrah.
Our last hurrah. We've got a bit of time. But I want to make sure that, like, is there a poem that you'd like to read? Like, one that you'd like to read?
You mentioned Juke. And this does some, well...
Oh, and we could go out on that song, too, if you want it. I don't know if we want to leave everyone with that, though, because I know you said it's not your favorite song.
Well, I'll read this. So maybe this poem gets at that rawness of selfhood and approach to poetry that I don't want people to lose in their studying and especially in their trying to be accepted and not rejected as poets. We have to retain the raw material that made us want to write in the first place. And I think that's what this poem does.
Yes.
Juke. What kind of juke do you prefer? For me, it's the kind with 3 songs and 37 blank title strips. 3 songs, and 2 are Luckenbach, Texas. The 3rd is beautiful and arcane, but the patrons hate it, and the record skips. I prefer the 3-song juke and the 3-toothed human smile. I found the juke of my dreams in a bar called Chums. No clue the origin or meaning of the quotation marks around the title. It was a prime number of a bar, and now it's dead. One night, drinking half and half, half beer, half tomato juice, with schnapps chasers, a cheap source of hallucination, a soon-to-be-defrocked Catholic priest, Vic, Jr., my mother, and me, our faces streaked blue with pool chalk, juke red as a beating heart, and just a strip of hollyhocks and a tree line between us and the northern lights. I was young. I looked like a Rubens painting of a woman half eaten by moths. What lucky debauchery, the ride back on a washboard dirt road, taking everything for granted, flipping off the aurora borealis like it was some three-toothed human in flashy clothes dancing to get my attention. I wasn't a mean drunk then, just honest. Next morning, Mom walked in on the naked priest in the shack's garage, washing himself with a rag and cold water from the well and a metal dishpan. I'd later do dishes in that pan and wash my hair in that pan. We popped popcorn on the one-burner wood-burning stove and ate it out of that pan. I'm talking about a time and a place. All I can say of it is that it was real. The song choices were limited, so the grooves were dug deep.
I'm so glad you read that one.
Thank you.
What do you think about when you're, because like you mentioned, hearing Gwendolyn Brooks read Diane, like that's also the gift that you're giving all of us by reading some of these poems, because the music also within them throughout makes them need to be allowed.
You know, poetry was and is an oral art, and that's one thing I love about it. It's writing, it's written, it's language, but it's also song, and you can't get the full effect without the human voice.
You can't.
I try to just read like I hear it in my head.
Why?
Because I think that's the most honest rendition. You know, I'm not trying to perform. it's just how I heard it when I was writing it. I carry poems around in my head, like my head is a tote bag for a while. And I hear them. I listen to the lines. And so by the time I get them to the page, you know, I've brought them into my mind and body as pieces of music, and that's how I hear them. And I'm able to write because I'm able to hear that music. Mm. See, I never would have said that as an 18-year-old. I would have said, what in the heck's music? What does that have to do with a poem? You know, I wouldn't have seen it.
Because you wanted to resist it. That was necessary for you to grow.
Yes. There was a younger poet on social media the other day talking about resistance, their resistance to forms, to traditional or given forms. And you know, I could really feel, like in my gut, what that resistance felt like. I don't feel it anymore, but I fully empathized with that. You know, it's like, don't tell me what to do, you know? it's adolescent in a way, but all developmental stages are worthy.
Yes.
And to resist is just as important as to accept.
I believe that too, Diane.
Yeah, I have firmly. A good potty training story about my son, but I won't go there.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was going to say, well, if it was about bear, that bear wouldn't mind.
Yeah, no, my kid wouldn't either, but he just was famous for saying, don't try to control my butt.
Oh.
So, you know, I mean, we don't want to be controlled.
Diane Seuss, thank you so much for today's program, and I can't wait to talk to you again soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time.
WCBN FM Ann Arbor Archives. Original air date July 24, 2015 at 9 a.m.
was Bianca. The stakes were getting high. She started mounting when I was Delton. I thought I'd just go along for the ride. I knew the ice queen. I knew the ice queen.
As the Stranglers fade out with that nice trombone riff, we come to 9 o'clock in the morning here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is Reverend Andrew, and this is now officially my show. I came in a little early so that Sean could skip out a little early. He has places to